Hello, everyone, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It is December the 7th of 2016. We're going to talk about some manga today. Chris, how you been?
How to respond to that without making things depressing?
Oh, okay.
The other day
I... starting things off on the right foot. Good.
The other day I stopped at Hardee's
and
didn't get violently ill.
Spiraling dark hole of bad emotions.
No, it's not bad. I'm just saying, like, I don't know what's happened in the past. You know what, actually, I've been getting a lot of compliments on my smell, Nick.
Your smell?
My smell.
Because
I keep weeks ago. Yeah, I had that one issue with the one girl where I was so sleep deprived she asked what cologne I was wearing. I couldn't think of a noun. Yeah. And within the past couple weeks now, I've gotten compliment on my cologne at least three more times. And this is an anomaly in and of itself because it's the same cologne I think I've been wearing for like 2 years. The only times I've ever had it been complimented, and it's happened all within the time span of like 2 months. And you'd think it'd be like, oh, that's kind of nice. Because this one time, a rather attractive woman who was at the facility I work at was the one to kind of bring it up. The unfortunate thing is I had released a very disgusting fart like 10 seconds before she had came by to compliment me on my cologne. So I was like, oh, well, I forgot to mention, your cologne is astounding. Like, what is that? And I'm just like, oh, man, maybe if I just scream it out really quickly, she'll get out of here before she smells it. It didn't. And it was like watching her face slowly like drop of like... Is that... Your cologne smells like farts now. What happened?
It changed miraculously now that I took a big whiff of it to enjoy the odor.
I'm like, no, that's your cologne. Your cologne smells like farts. She's like, I don't wear cologne. And I certainly wouldn't wear cologne made of smell of farts. I'm like...
I think I would, at least.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's check the bottle. Maybe it does happen. Maybe your cologne has an active ingredient, farts, and you're just not realizing it. I don't know.
Oh, boy.
Now, where do farts come out of, Nick?
Farts come out your butthole.
Now, butts. Does that remind you of anything?
I guess it reminds me various songs that are about the hindquarters. It reminds me of Beavis and Butthead. Reminds me of that.
Understandable. There's a lot of songs about it. Butt songs are becoming more and more prevalent, too.
Yeah, I think one or two years ago was named, like, Year of the Butt or something because it was such a big thing. Like, it was a very, very common subject in pop culture, particularly in pop music. Okay.
Do we just want to get to it, Nick? Do we just
the manga we're talking about is full of ass, like literal ass, butts, right up in your face.
Wait, I was gonna say that's a misleading statement, Nick, because there are butts in everything. There are butts in One Piece, but they're not the focus. They don't fight with their butts.
I really wish that because I had thought of like getting like action figures or something to hold up, like you know, tilt them down in order to illustrate what this series is like. Because essentially it involves like, okay, here are my two little finger ears, and then turn them around this way, and then they go like this a whole lot.
That visual representation one works great on a podcast.
Yes, we've got video screen. Shut up.
Yeah.
The manga that we're talking about is Keijo, which is a series that has gotten an anime adaptation recently. It's currently airing right now, actually.
It's been one of the hits of the 2016 fall anime season.
One of the hits. It's no Yuri on Ice in terms of like overwhelming positive, reception. But it is something that definitely I think has stood out. The impression that I've gotten from looking at, cause you know, I don't watch much anime, but I do follow a number of people who do. The general idea that I get from looking at stuff is that in this year of this entire calendar year, there have been a lot of forgettable series. Not a lot has really stood out. Aside from Yuri on Ice, that's the one that seemingly everyone loves. I have not tried watching it, mostly because I don't watch anime in general. But the other one that got a lot of people's attention just because it's so absurdly in-your-face, ridiculous it was, with Keijo, which is about a young girl in swimsuits fighting each other with their boobs and butts. This is a ridiculous series. It is ridiculous for all of the reasons that write on the cover, which is girls in swimsuits fight each other using their boobs and butts. You don't really need any other explanation. Exactly what it sounds like. It's a little weird to talk about it, honestly, in general, just because it is so blatantly absurd. And it's absurd on purpose, but it's also played straight, if you know what I mean. Because it comes off like it's a joke. Because it is a joke. It's, you know, like, oh, wouldn't it be weird if we took, you know, the fan service-y fights that you see in a lot of shonen manga. We're just gonna posing in ways that essentially busts under. And it's like, well, what if they just fought each other with boobs and butts?
Yes.
Well, there you go. That's the joke, but it's played straight because, well, for the most part, it's played straight because it really is just kind of a martial arts series or a sports series that just happens to have an incredibly potent focus on tits and ass.
I want to interject with a little anecdote here.
Go ahead.
So I mentioned a couple weeks back, maybe like a month and a half ago, I mentioned I was starting up a live D&D group. And we've still been playing, and about 2 weeks ago, I think it was, one of the players mentioned, like, the topic of anime came up, we were mentioned some things, and the one dude started laughing, he's like, yo, guys, have you seen the butt anime yet? And all of us just like, what? No, what the fuck are you talking about? And he's like, oh, it's like all the, everything in it, like it's butts, and there's like, the opening is like butts in the sky, like a cloud's a butt, and all
this.
And I was like, this sounds fucking ridiculous. Until, cut to about like halfway into, like, after we had picked Taijo, we had like the next session, and he was bringing it up again, and I was like, wait a minute, what's the name of that anime? I don't remember it. I was like, and I looked up what our suggestion was, like, is it Kaijo? He's like, yeah, I think that's it. I was like, fuck, we're doing the butt anime. God damn it. Like, I had this stuff. I was like, damn it, everything that was so stupid that he was talking about, that's what I have to read now. And I came in under that initial impression of it. Like, is this going to be the stupidest thing ever? And it is. It is one of the dumbest things you'll read.
It is stupid.
But at the start, definitely, it surpasses a lot of expectations because it's dumb in what I found to be a slightly enjoyable way. It's all kinds of, like, ridiculousness. But at the start, it handles itself well because, like Food Wars, say, it has its fan service, but it does it to a degree that's so absurd you can't help but kind of laugh at it. And as you said, it takes the rest of its world seriously. A little too seriously when, like, within the first chapter they mention how Keijo's responsible for deaths and multiple ones per year. People die playing this fucking butt sumo thing on the water. But, you know, otherwise they handle it relatively well. And what was most surprising to me is that despite the premise, you know, young girls in bikinis fighting in this butt versus boob sumo match.
Now, Chris, they are not bikinis. They are one-piece suits.
Sometimes they're bikinis, though. And they do this in front of what they describe as mostly, like, middle-aged men because it's, like, big betting thing. I would have assumed that the in-universe...
With regular bettors that examine the competitors like horses.
Yeah.
At the horse races.
I would have assumed that the in-universe scandalous nature of this would be more emphasized, but it isn't. They actually don't act like it's nothing, like it's a suggestive or weird profession at all. Like the sexual tantalization of this sport is never addressed early on. it's acted like, hey, this is just a thing we do. This is like that people are watching just for the pure love of the sport and the adrenaline it gives you. And I was like, I'm all on board with that. Like, if it's one thing.
That is the kind of the thing is that really does, I think, boost the series in my eyes because there are a couple of perverted characters. It's an inevitable thing when you've got a mostly female cast that are all attractively drawn females who are pressing their naughty bits against each other. That is bound to happen. It is inevitable that there is going to be lesbianism in the series. But there aren't any characters that are like, oh yeah, I love seeing those girls in swimsuits rub up against each other.
That's what I assume make, the audience
would make the series as a whole way creepier than it is.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it's one thing to be on one hand to be the reader finding things sexy because, you know what? Yes, obviously that's part of the intention of this series. You can't base something on boobs and butts battling each other without trying to obviously put a fan service element in there. But if it's that, that's up to the audience to decide whether or not they're perverted and find it attractive or whatever they want with that. As opposed to being a reader and being forced to read other people's perversion, like other characters' perversions in reaction to that. It'd be different. For example, our main character, Kaminashi, I believe is her name. She starts the series off as a gymnast, and she announces how she's not going to do this shit anymore because there's no money in gymnastics, whereas Keijo
has
all the money.
She's very pragmatic about it.
Yes.
She's not like a super greedy character. She's got dreams of wealth and fame, but it's because her family is poor. And so she's like, oh yeah, I'm super athletic. I could go into gymnastics, but
there's
you don't
no money,
make a whole
and if
lot
you get
of money
injured, you're fucked.
You know, yeah. Like the sponsorship deals run out.
Wheaties ain't making the money they used to. So she decides to enter Keijo, and she has a friend, a male friend, same school, and it's kind of obvious that he has a bit of a crush on her. They go to Keijo, they watch a match, and she's like, I'm entering this. And he objects. And my first thought would have been like, he's going to object because he's going to be like, you can't be out, like, you'd be the fucking white knight. Like, you can't expose and put your body out there on the line for all these people to watch you to bikini. No, his only thought's like, people are dying out there. You don't have the physique for this. And not like, your boobs aren't big. Like, he's just like, you're too small. It seems like a power sport. It won't work for you. It's like, this is like a very pragmatic way of doing this. It never has to bring up the sexual nature at all. And that's refreshing considering how sexually charged it initially appears. That said, as time goes on, the independence the series has in that nature does start to fade away a little bit as I think more and more characters start to get
respect, yeah.
They start to get a little bit more fan servicey and aware of it, like, oh, watching that made me kind of hot. It's usually within the other girls competing in this sport, but they make mention of that stuff every now and again, and it does start to take away from it, especially because this manga does something really strange for a sports series. The first chapter has a titular Keijo fight. You do not get another one for 20 chapters plus later. You have essentially like a 3-volume break between your fucking first and second Keijo match, which is a mind-boggling decision because everything in between is the most boring stuff to read through.
I watched a couple of episodes of the anime, and they pretty much skip that entire sequence, which I actually disagree with. I think that whole test, it definitely goes on way too long, but I found it to be invaluable to actually building the characters of the main two characters, Kaminashi and Miyata. Like, without that, it's just kind of like, okay, we're just going to start the action. And you don't really know anything about them because it's just focusing on what is admittedly the main draw of the series, the ridiculous boobs and butts fight and the spectacle of that. It just skips straight to that point. And then after doing that, it's like, okay, now they're actually at the school, now we'll build their characters up again. Because it's not until they actually get into the academy that the grand majority of the cast is actually introduced. But getting to know Kaminashi and Miyata in that entrance exam arc, I thought was actually one of the better parts of the series. But yeah, it does definitely go on way too freaking long.
Like
3 volumes between that is too much. There are too many non-fighting each other tests in this that are stupid.
It would be like if Ice Shield 21 started with Senna scoring his first touchdown in the first chapter. Then the next three volumes after that are him running combine drills, all crotch-related combine drills with his buddies as they try to figure out the sport of football. And then you get to their second match. You're just like, come on, man.
Eyeshield 21 did have the important lesson that the line had to learn, which was the ass explosion.
That is true. The muscles from the ass. It's everywhere, guys. You can't stop this. Yeah.
Ass is the biggest muscle in the body.
It is true. There's parts to Keijo that I absolutely can't appreciate. I think if you're someone who's going to enjoy the humor in it and, like, you find the hysterical nature of, like, I tweeted this out and I put a Keijo gif to it. And it's a girl, Miyata, going up to do, like, a fucking, you know, one of those things that's shown in characters do, like, the punching, like, where you see, like, 20 fists flying because that fast.
She does Gomu Gomu Gatling with her butt.
Yeah, it's one of those things. If you're like, that's fucking hysterical. Like, that's amazing. Like, I think you definitely can enjoy this large part of the series. I do appreciate that, you know, for a series that is about, you know, battling butts and everything like that, they have a wide variety of female body types on display. I think that was actually something I enjoyed. Because you don't see that generally. Like, there's one of the major characters is, like, extremely muscular. And that's not something you generally see in a lot of...
Well, she's not actually one of the main characters. Well, she shows up in an early...
She's very relevant at that point, I should say.
It is honestly refreshing that it's, I think that because of the series' obsession with anatomy, they go to extreme lengths to make all, you know, characters seem to have, because that's a big thing is, you know, this character is heavier, this character's proportions are different. And so because of that, that's where you get a lot of the clashing styles because they have clashing body types. It's not just, you know, everyone has, you know, 36 triple E boobs and a 38-inch waist with 20, or 38-inch hips, rather, with 24-inch waist. Mm. There are different proportions that the girls have in order to get those different fashion styles. Still, a lot of emphasis is put on, look at her ass. Look at her ass, right up, drawn really big, sticking out there. There you go.
There's a ton of that, and you get from all the areas of this. Like, I'll be front when I say I don't find this manga particularly hysterical. Like, there's only so many times they can make the, like, butt being as emphasis as it is joke before I just kind of like, I've heard this. Like, you know, not I don't think there's a nicer way to say this other than, like, a little bit old, too old for that kind of level of humor. But there are still times where I'm like, admittedly, this was so stupid, it's hilarious. One moment being Miyata. She's the secondary character, I guess you could say. She is a former judo star, and she has a very thin frame. Particularly, she has very, very small breasts. And there's one moment she's fighting against...
She's got this running gag that everyone... Because Kaminashi is just very stereotypical shonen protagonist, always says the first thing that pops into her head, and so she's constantly going, oh, Miyata, your chest is so small. Don't worry about it, though. And she's just like, I don't care, and she very obviously cares, and she's the flattest character in the
match. Yeah. So she's fighting against somebody, and she is kind of like trying to get the upper hand, and her opponent has one of those moments where she's like, wait a minute, did her chest just grow like 10 sizes? And, like, you see a shot of Miyata with, like, an ample bosom. And that's when, like, the turnabout happened. She's like, no, that wasn't her chest. It was her butt! And she just, like, flipped herself up that fast that the after image looked like it was there. And it was actually her butt. She's looking like boobs. And it was a counterattack and she beat me. And you're like, this is so, like, this is such a shonen trope. Like, what happened to that? Oh, it was actually an after image and I confused it. No, you've gotten like, it's such a trope within shonen that they just manipulated it into a butt joke that every so often they'll catch me and I'll be like, that's kind of funny because it's so dumb. But you have to get through a lot of butt jokes. You have to get through a lot of like, my butt's not strong enough. My butt is a predator on the prowl. My butt is not able to reflect this. I need to master my butt senses. Like, these are all literal phrases from the series, basically.
The main character's signature vacuum ass cannon. Mm. Like, come on. what was I that? Mean, there are moments that are definitely like, where something that is just so absurd that even in a sea of different butt jokes, it's so ridiculous that it gets out of.
Here's a quote from a page, actually. It's like a hunter watching out for its prey with an emphasis on a butt within a forest. Then a girl responds, "The aura around her butt changed?" And another character said, "Are you trying to decide it by your butt's instinct? That's insane! As good as your reflexes are!" That's what this series is.
I think that over and over. Talking about hitting a volleyball.
Yeah, it's trying to sense whether it's a squishy volleyball or a hard volleyball by using just the senses of your butt and its aura. It's a shonen battle manga in the guise of a sports manga that is all about butts. And it's an interesting combination, to say the least.
I think that the first big moment that did it for me is in that same sequence where Miyata does her after image thing. Nozomi smashes her foot down into the platform that she's on, and it sprays up a curtain of water like a smoke screen. And so in a moment like that, you know, you're expecting the attack to come, or, you know, it's just, you know, a fist coming out. But of course, because they attack each other with their beaks and asses, it's just instead a butt coming through this curtain of water
for
the finishing blow. Like, that's just so, such a weird parody of a moment like that from battle manga, that it gets a reaction out of me. I think that maybe actually if this weren't something that we had to read in one go, that maybe those moments would have been a bit more individually memorable, because you have time for, you don't have as much time to become immune to seeing, a boob joke, an ass joke, and so on. But at the same time, this is not really a manga that I wanted reading. It's not that I didn't enjoy it. I don't think it's a bad manga, but I really don't want to keep reading it, because there are bits here and there that I think, okay, in fact, it is a much better series than I think it has any right being. But even so, it's really hard to get over the mass fighting violence of it.
Yeah. It's better than it should be, and I think part of that comes with the fact that It's as you mentioned, it's basically parody. It's a parody of shonen battle manga that also embraces it in its own way.
It's a little bit blatant about it than, say, Toriko in the parody.
Yeah.
Like, Toriko, you can tell there are some bits where it's clearly a joke. But it's easier to take Toriko seriously, than it is this.
But I would say, like, if you were to, say, like, compare this to Fairy Tail or to Air Gear, other series that we've read that we've had issues with their fan service before, the fan service in this is all probably, well, not Air Gear, but it's probably, actually, Fairy Tail might have overdone it too at some points. But it's very blatant, but it's aware of its blatancy. And if not, it's going so over the top that, again, you can't take it as seriously as, like, a moment in Fairy Tail where, you know, the villain of the fucking arc is torturing Urza with sexual powers, something like that. Like, that's always just creepy. This isn't creepy, it's just goofy and silly because of how ridiculous it is. Now, that said, it's still going to be something.
The thing that separates it, I think, from Fairy Tail and Air Gear is that a fan service fight in those series won't then turn around and expect you to get serious about a fight, you know, between, like, you know, Natsu and Zeref, or directly after having this fight between two girls, which is literally just the excuse for their clothes to get torn up and for them to be put in compromising poses. This series is entirely girls being put in compromising poses that sometimes it's played for laughs, and sometimes it's played a little bit more seriously. And because of that, you don't have that really weird backlash between them, and it doesn't feel like none of the girls are played less seriously than others. It's not like, oh yeah, when girls fight, you know, it's time to take a break and get your dick out.
Yeah, as you said, butts are the method of attack, so regardless of whether it's the joke of watching a butt come out of the water or the finishing blow, it's always kind of there. So the butt element, it's weird to say, the butt element doesn't shift the dramatic tension of the story per se, because it's a constant. It's always there. You're always going to be kind of getting a wink at the camera, but at the same time, it does everything else that like a battle manga would do. There are turnabouts. There are dramatic tension moments where the hero looks like they're completely beaten. There's, you know, rivals and antagonists and power-ups. There's even a boob recovery arc at one point. Like, you know,
there's intense training sequences. The key to taking a huge step forward is to master nipple techniques.
Yeah, like, but it's...
But it plays itself, it takes itself seriously. It is just, you know, a sports or martial arts series that uses fan service fights.
Yes. I will say that one thing I found very odd about it is, so Kaminashi has her own backstory. She's grew up in a poor household. She basically takes care of her younger brother and sister, and her goal in life is to become a keijo player, mostly because she wants the money that comes with it. But she also kind of wants it as like a little bit of a passion. It's primarily for the money, but she has a conversation with Miata at one point later on where she kind of talks about how she kind of likes the glamour and the world traveling and all that would come with a keijo, being a pro keijo player. So you get a decent idea of what she's like. It becomes, unfortunately, somewhat of a forgotten element from her. At least she doesn't recall it or use it as much motivation. She kind of is just like, I want to be that good, and you're just, I guess, meant to remember, which is fine. But her friend Miata has her own story, which is oddly complex and I can't think of the word for it. It's not bleak, but it's, I'll basically just explain it to you in small spoilers, I guess.
I love Miata, by the way.
Couple
she arcs. Was like that. She was easily the standout character in the series, and I think a big reason why I got more into the series perspective.
So her backstory is that she's a former judo star, essentially a shoo-in for nationals to be the national representative for Japan. And she was all the way to that match and the favorite going into it. And in that match, she suddenly realized she had no passion for the sport. It was apathy. She stopped caring and threw the match because of it. And she has an opponent in Keijo later on who is admonishing her for that. Like, do you know what you did? Your opponent was so embarrassed by what you did that they fell into a deep spiral of depression, was eliminated in their first match at the Olympics, and has been hounded mercilessly by the media ever since then. And it sends Miata in a little bit of a spiral again, because she's like, oh, I guess I caused that. You then find out later that that isn't what happened, and that Miata gave up because she saw that opponent talking to her coach and saw how excited that person was for the sport, and she's like, she deserves it because she actually has passion for this. And that afterwards the two of them were like best friends or something like that. And I guess she did lose at the first round of the Olympics and get harassed, but it's sort of weird. They don't explain whether or not the other girl was lying or just didn't know the situation, actually. But it's just this weirdly... Again, I can't think of the word for it, but it's almost like kind of morose to think that there's a story of this character who's like, I was a player, a top-level player in another sport, and I gave up because I realized I had no fucking passion for it. It's a lot like, what was the MMA manga we read, the female MMA manga, Natsuo, I think was the main character in it.
Tepu.
It's a lot like the main character from that in a way, like a character who's really good at a sport but just doesn't really care until finally something like gets them motivated. But she doesn't get motivated for judo. She just switches over to this other sport for.
Well, they explore her backstory more. They explore her backstory more. Going into it, and they essentially explained that, like, she really never had a passion for judo. Mm-hmm. It just took her a while to really actually have to take the step to get out of it. You know, she was pressured by her father to go into it, and then when she wanted to get out of it, he was very much against it, just because she had spent so long training for judo that to suddenly switch to a different sport, she would be at a tremendous disadvantage. But apparently she just always wanted to go into keijo. She always thought it was hers, I guess.
Yeah, that's the weird part of it, is like her ambition for why she wants to be a keijo player really doesn't seem to be anything more than like it'd be nice to travel the world and get like designer bikinis. It's like the two things they mention at the start.
the way that she puts it is, I wanted to wear a cute swimsuit.
And I'm like, people die in this sport. Get your own fucking designer bikini somewhere, I'd imagine.
Become a famous judo star and use the money to have them design it for you. I really like Miyata's character, though. It's, she, you know, in the same sense that Kaminashi is, you know, the very shonen-style hero who says everything that's on her mind, wears her heart in her sleeve, and is just takes on every challenge in a headstrong manner. She's the more cold, reserved, calculating competitor. But there's a sense about her that she's that way because she's led this life of discipline up to this point. She was training in judo her whole, just doing everything very seriously. And you get the sense that she's just that way just because of life, and she wants to be more open to things. She wants to, you know, make friends, and have a much more fun life, but she just doesn't really know how to do it yet. So she's just got difficulty opening up if she wants to. Which is kind of refreshing when you consider all the different, you know, Sasukes of the world where it's like, I must follow my duty no matter what, and then they have to have the power of friendship beaten over their head in order to accept it. It makes the relationship between Kaminashi and Miyata a lot more enjoyable. They reach an understanding pretty early on in the series, and they do get along while still just maintaining their characters. It's not like Miyata ever, it's like, oh, I'm sorry that I've been such a bitch this whole time. I'll be much friendlier now. It's like, no, you don't have to stop being the way that you are in order to be someone. Mm-hmm. That said, though, Miyata did have moments in the series that made me facepalm. There were a couple of ones, but this was like the very big one for me, where I just had to I literally stopped reading the manga about 2 minutes as I just processed what had just happened. Because Miyata is what's called an outfighter. By the way, there are three different types of Keijo players in the series, which are called infighters, outfighters, and, like, counter-specialists. The terms outfighter and infighter don't really make sense, because infighting, the term comes from, you know, wanting to charge in and punch, and outfighting means you use longer-range attacks in boxing, like, you extend your fist out more in order to catch someone as they're coming in. You can't really do that with your butt. There's they only so ways. Far you can thrust your butt out. but the idea is that, you know, there's power fighters, there's speed fighters, and that there's counter fighters. So Miyata's a speed specialist and Kaminashi's a power specialist. Makes sense. So Miyata, is an incredibly fast fighter, but in order to achieve her maximum speed, she has created this special technique. You see, the swimsuits are really form-fitting, but even so, sometimes they get in the way, and they cause friction, and they get in the way. So in order to achieve her maximum speed, she gives herself
a wedgie. Okay.
And the first time that she does this, I saw the panel, and I just had to stop. It wasn't... I didn't have the reaction of this is so ridiculous, you know, that's so shameless, or that's so funny. I just was like,
you're like, you win manga for tonight. You just like closed your laptop, quietly went over to like go to bed. You're just like, no, we're talking about this tomorrow.
And she creates also an improved version of this technique. Because, see, she might have a lot more surface area exposed and therefore less friction, but there is still a little bit of fabric there. So later on, she gives herself a wedgie so hard that she tears the crotch of her swimsuit to expose her entire ass in order to go even faster! It's such a stupid manga. It is so stupid and ridiculous. But you know what? I have been keeping up with Yu-Gi-Oh! For about 15 years now. Not quite 15 years, but getting close to it now.
Prepare yourself, everybody. This might be the only time Keijo and Yu-Gi-Oh! Are about to be compared to one another.
No, the thing is, when you've got... Like, look, Yu-Gi-Oh! Was ridiculous to begin with, because you just had to accept that a game was so popular that they would... A card game was so popular that there was actually a market for holographic stadiums and then mini holographic stadiums that you could carry around on your wrist, and that it was actually related to an ancient Egyptian game. You just had to accept all of that. But then things got, as each different spin-off came, a new ridiculous premise was added onto it. In 5Ds you had, now they play card games on specially designed motorcycles. For some reason, and there are these huge arena events like that are like chariot races. And of course, then there was Yu-Gi-Oh! GX was the first one that came out, where you had to accept that Duel Monsters was such a popular game that an entire school, multiple entire schools, were created specifically to further the game, as in training better players, training people who would create new cards and design new cards, and which was an element that really probably should have actually been explored more, but just like, they duel at school. So that was all they cared about. And that's what Keijo is that it's this gambling sport that has gotten so huge that it has taken over this world. There is an entire institute, a college-level academy, that Kaminashi and Miyata and their classmates and to train them to be better players. And there are guys who attend the school to become Keijo engineers, which literally is just they design new flotation platforms for them to fight on. I'm pretty sure that there is not a pro wrestling school where they just train people to design new rings. But you just kind of have to get past all that in order to get into the series. If you're caught on details like, why is there literally an entire school to train people for this? Which, by the way, Keijo exists in the real world. I don't think it's called Keijo. And I tried literally up to try and find out the first time that it happened, but in Japan, there have been competitions where girls in swimsuits try and bump their butts against each other in order to knock each other off of a platform in the middle of a pool into the water.
I think it was a mini.
That's something that's been happening for at least 10 years.
Beach volleyball, actually.
But it's been happening for at least 10 years. I don't know when it first started. As far as I've been able to determine, it's shown up in, like, you know, comedy variety shows, and it's shown up as like a mini game in some of the Dead or Alive games. But it does exist. But someone had watched it and was like, this could be an extreme combat sport that takes over the world. And if you're stuck on that by saying, this is ridiculous, then you will have a hard time enjoying this series. If you have a problem playing fan service, you will have a hard time enjoying this series. But if you can look at it and you see a couple of fights and you're like, that was entertaining in an absurd kind of way, then you could get something out of the month. You could enjoy some of it. If you get a little bit into it, then you might even discover that some characters have kind of interesting backstories because the series takes itself seriously. And honestly, a joke like this needs to be delivered straight in order for it to have any impact. Because if all the characters are like, this is ridiculous, all these girls are doing is throwing their butts at each other, then it wouldn't be nearly as effective. If there were a character who was just like, it's kind of really sexual the way that they're doing this, and that was something that happened all the time, it would be a lot less funny. It's probably the best possible result that could have resulted from such a premise. It is still weird as fuck, but I have to give props where props are due, because this should never have worked in any sense. And it did, kind of.
See, I didn't have much issue with accepting this world, if only because I just finished Westworld. And if you watch that series, it's really entertaining, but you can't question how things work. You can't be like, how does this park make money if they have to constantly fix up all these hosts who have storylines where many of them end up shooting each other at the end of the day, even if there's no other guests around? What's the, like, the financial thing of this would be astronomical. Like, yeah, it's the whole, like, the butt game that's apparently so popular that many women can go and go to these specialized schools. Essentially, just imagine a world where football didn't exist and Keijo was there instead. Because there are, like, schools that are essentially football schools, and that's what Keijo basically puts in. I do think that there's definitely people who are going to really enjoy this series, and I think even to a small extent, I could say I enjoyed it as well. The issue with me is I don't find the butt joke that funny. Like, every so often, it does it in a funny way that's, you know, great. And I actually do applaud the series for trying to get as much versatility out of it. Like, again, they have various ways of implementing characters with unique powers, unique styles, interesting turnabouts. The main character, she isn't, like, necessarily the fastest or strongest. Her thing often tends to be that she has a very sharp mind as well, and she's very resourceful. So she sometimes uses trickery or things like that to get ahead. And it's appreciated, but there's an obvious limitation when your only method of fighting is the butt. You see a lot of things several times over. But all that said, if you...
I should note that the only rules in Keijo, they are that you can't use your arms and legs. Mm-hmm. So I was really waiting for a moment where one of the girls was just like, fuck all of this boobs and butt nonsense, just started headbutting the other
just people. Fucking, like, Muay Thai, just fucking, like, kneeing people in the face. But yeah, like, if you find the joke funny, it's enjoyable. But every time I hear butt, I feel like I'm talking about it in a different way. The thing is that if you're even somebody who's kind of, like, okay with it for a little bit, but you start to dip on it, it's unfortunately, that's just what it's going to be. Like, it's not anything more than that. It's going to be a lot of fun for some people. For other people, it's just going to be the butt manga, which is fine. It's just know what you're getting into, essentially. And it definitely helps if you're already a fan of, like, shonen battle or sports series, because that's where a lot of its influences are coming from.
I think that about covers everything.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's only... There really, all right,
let's
only
go home, Nick.
It should have probably...
Oh, wait, I'm home. All right. Well, I'm going to go down to bed, and you stay right there. You just finish the show.
All right. Okay. Moving on from that, we're going to talk about manga now, which... I think features a lot less butts.
Did you read Fairy Tale this week? I saw butts all over the place. Actually, not really.
But... as far as I remember, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway, yeah, let's just start. We're going to also do a random order again. I think that we might end up doing this until we have something to end on in an alphabetical order that isn't Ruby, because I don't...
Yeah, Rick doesn't read it, and I still barely know what's happening in it, so hopefully World Trigger comes back soon, but I think in the meantime we'll just randomize it. Oh, actually, I'm just going to take the opportunity now before we start the podcast proper. I usually deliver it at the end of it, but I just wanted to throw at the top of it. We do a bonus podcast every month for the Patreon, and we just released our November one. It was a little bit late, but it's out there now, and if you were a Patreon November, you couldn't, you know, stay in, just let me know. If you need to get the episode, just email me and I can get it to you. But we're announcing what the December one's going to be within that episode. We'll put it out here as well. Last year for December, we did a radio play about, like, a Bleach Christmas Carol, where it was Nick being visited by the three ghosts of Bleach, past, present, and future. So in a similar vein to that, this year we're going to be doing a radio play that's going to be the alternate ending of Bleach as portrayed by us. So it's going to be a very silly thing, but it's going to be very fun too. And it's going
to
be...
Which means I get to do my Yuhobok voice more.
Yeah, it's going to be ultimately there for Nick to be Yuhobok again. I'm going to give him crazy long monologues. But there'll be sound effects and music and, you know, special guests in it and bloopers and all that sort of stuff. It'll be the same kind of thing as last time, but hopefully even more fun and more awesome. So if you want to check it out, just make sure you're a patron through the month, a champion patron through the month of December, and you'll be able to get that link. It'll probably come out towards the end of the month because it's going to be a shit ton of work doing it, and I have a lot of other things to do this month as well, but
yeah,
it will be out there.
If our Bleach Christmas Carol was a thing to learn, that'll take a lot of time.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. What's our first manga we're reading this week, Nick?
The first manga that we landed on is Food Wars.
Okay. I was like, I swear to God, if you say Ruby, I'm killing you.
It's chapter 194, The Price. Last time, Joichiro and Sensemon showed up in order to back up Soma's challenge against Izane for the seats of the council, introducing the Regiment de Cuisine Shokugeki, which we get an explanation on, a very helpful explanation in the very first page of the chapter, which explains exactly how the team fight works. It's teams of five strive to survive, but what you start off is you pair off all five members of each team against each other, then the winners of those teams are left, of those individual competitions are left, then you decide new individual competitions with the remaining players, and you keep on going like that until only one team's player wins.
It's interesting,
so
because...
No cooperation, really. It's more... But it's a much more traditional kind of shonen team battle dynamic, where, you know...
Well, it's going to be interesting,
because... We sit our guy against your guy, and we have to decide who matches.
Because it's going to imply, I'm going to assume Tsukasa ends up on Azami's team.
If Azami doesn't choose Tsukasa, then he's a fucking fool.
He's like looking at like the Council 10, he's like, Azon. Whoever the seventh seat is now. Ninth seat. Ninth seat's vacant. He just fired Hayama. I'll take the chair. and, what, Subaru, what are you doing?
Which among these council members is most likely to throw the match? Rindo, you go.
who's the least trustful of my subordinates?
Your dish is yummy, I forfeit.
Oh, who could have seen this coming? But yeah, it's curious, because I'm like, how do they get around not having somebody defeat Tsukasa then? Like, I was assuming if it's like a team competition and like the total things are weighed, then you could be like, well, the total of Soma's team was better or something like that. But this, like, someone's going to have to outright beat them, Tsukasa, to win it.
And we still haven't solved the issue of, it's teams of five, apparently. But the Resistance still only has four chefs that are... You got Soma, you got Arina, you got Takumi, and Tada. So who did their fifth chef be?
Still not even exactly clear if Arina is going to be on their team or not.
Right, because she's part of the council.
Yeah, because even...
I mean, technically, I guess you could just have teams of any number of chefs go up against each other because of the individual knockout element.
Mm-hmm.
But they do seem to imply from that graphic that it's five against five.
Yeah, that seems to be at least the traditional setup for it, and what I'd assume they do. But
maybe
yeah,
they'll have to have as many chefs to go up against every council member. Who knows?
That'd be pretty crazy, but it'd be kind of interesting. Although they also said like their plan was to get a majority on the council, so it could just be that they'll put up five and be like, "Hey, or this is what we need to get majority."
So we pick things up with Joichiro trying to get Azami to accept the challenge for the team battle. But Azami says that he doesn't really have any reason to accept still, because his plan was already almost completely done once he became the dean of the Institute, so everything else is now just kind of tidying things up. There's no reason for him to accept the challenge. So Joichiro says, alright, well, what if I become one of your soldiers if I lose?
I hope Red Taro joins the team, Nick.
Who?
Rintaro. He becomes like their fourth member to join the council. Yeah. But his outfit's gotten more stupid.
You would be able to represent the council even though you were easily defeated by one of the guys who was already lost.
Like somehow he shows up and his outfit's even more distracting and busy. Like he's got like a half hawk or something like that, but it's on the other side from the earring.
He's got really, really ugly facial tattoos.
He's got, like, bear claws crafted onto his regular hands.
He's got a facial tattoo, but it's, like, only on his nose.
He has a robot bird that's on his shoulder who squawks and makes sarcastic remarks.
Oh, your upside-down crosses are so cool!
His tank treads for feet. Why is this Shokugeki Hall wheelchair accessible? Also tank tread accessible.
Joichiro promises to shut down Yukihira for good if the team loses, and he'll become a pawn for your true gourmet ideals. And Zami gets really excited when he hears the plan, so he agrees to the deal. Sensemon starts setting up some particulars in order order to decide when and where they'll have the competition. He basically points out, hey, let's just hold it where and when the final advancement exam was going to be. Just kind of skip the two in between anyway. They're no longer important. We're going to just drop this advancement exam plot that nobody was into. Takumi and Takaro are both on board with this plan. Takumi is all determined, and Megumi, of course, is nervous, but she says that she's going to fight to save her friends. It's nice to see her stepping up. Irina looks most nervous of all, of course, because she's like, well, shit, we're going up against my dad. This is it. No turning back now. And Azami shoots her a pretty dirty look when he's getting on board the helicopter and flying away. Juichiro says that they're going to undergo special training. Tuki's like, what do you mean? Well, you're going to get your asses kicked if you right now. So, yeah. They're going to start getting ready training, but they're going to hold off on that until the next day. So time passes until night. Deutro is sitting at a bar. I don't know why there is a fucking bar at this train that is transporting high school kids, but there it is.
I assume Tatsuki Institute's just so wealthy and stupid with their money that they just throw a wet bar into everything they have. Like, it's just like, this is our music hall, of course, with its own wet bar over there.
That bartender, like, never gets to serve anyone because it's just constantly underage kids that are coming in. I guess I'll just polish more glasses then.
I sometimes spit into the glass so I'll have something to clean out of it. My tip jar is empty and full of spider webs. I'd clean it out, but there's a big spider that I'm scared of.
Everyone's just asking him to hand them canned sodas underneath the bar. And just like, will you at least ask for a virgin drink? Give me something to mix. Can I have some tap water?
There's bottled water right behind you. I want it out of the spritzer. It tastes different.
The real reason why I'm so depressed is because I want to give these people life-changing advice via drinks, but none of them can drink the drink that I would be mixing for them because they're underage and can't consume
fuck it. Megumi, the perfect drink for you is this water, because just like you, it's complicated with many layers, but you have to let the water at the bottom rise above the water at the... There's layers to the drink as well, you just can't see... get your shit together, girl.
I will pour a little bit of salt in this water. So, see, the way that the salt is now rising to the top, that is like you rising to the top of the school. So you just have to give it time and be willing to, I don't know, pour salt in things.
Erina, you're a lot like this can of Coke. This can of Coke also has serious issues with its father.
Sealed. Your emotions were sealed and everything was waiting to come out and then... They were all shaken up inside. If you had let them rest first, they wouldn't have exploded. Wow, I'm actually really good at this, my boy.
He's like, wow, I'm amazing.
Now imagine if I had actual material to work with.
Yeah, if I had some fucking obscure-ass fucking liquor from 20th century Norway.
See, Soma, you're like my pee in this glass.
You're also very pissy and...
acidic. It should not be consumed.
And red, which probably should be checked at by a doctor.
Excuse me, I have to dial.
So I'm going to pass out now.
Where were we? Soma approaches Joichiro at the bar and starts talking to him about it. You know, why are you making that? Why'd you make that bet? Joichiro's trying to get in, like, oh, come on. Like, you know, you should be confident in it. And also, that was literally the only leverage we had, so give me a break. Soma brings up that he actually doesn't know very much about Joichiro as a chef, and so they started to have a little bit of a heart-to-heart, but before that, we cut away to where Dojima is sitting with Megumi and Takumi in the lounge car. And he reveals that he actually arranged for Sendamon to show up there. And they've been working in secret to try and build a strategy to retake the school. So, also, Dojima says that he's kind of been using the resistance for their own purposes, using the exams for their own purposes in order to try and reach something like this, to reach a point where they could actually directly challenge the school. He then holds up a picture to them and starts to go over his shared past with Azami and with Joichiro. And he says that Joichiro was the axis around whom all evolved. But Takumi brings up, wait, that doesn't... I thought that you were the top chef in your era. I thought that you were the top member of the Council of Ten and you were seen as the greatest chef. And Dojima says, actually, I wasn't. Joichiro and I faced off in Shokugeki a total of 121 times and I lost 101 of them. The greatest chef of the class wasn't me, it was Joichiro Saiba. And we can get a little bit of a flashback with Dojima with hair and glasses talking with Joichiro, going over some stuff together. Joichiro, trying to convince them to hold Shokugeki with people so that they could increase Polaris Dorm's standing. Dojima just goes over what kind of a person that Joichiro was in school. And we also see a kid Nakamura who is super, like, reserved. Don't leave me behind, senpai kind of character. It's very off-putting for what an evil person he would become later on. To see him in his little sweater vest going like, oh, I'm coming, senpai!
Hey!
Baka! Joichiro, at the same time, is offering some of the same details to Soma. And he says, however, that halfway through his third year, he actually left Totsuki. Essentially, he dropped out. And Dojima says, by the time this picture was taken, it had already begun. The culinary world that we saw and strove for, and the one that Joichiro saw, had slowly, quietly started drifting apart. So, essentially... they were all on the same page together when they were attending Totsuki Academy, all striving towards that goal that seemingly Azami is striving for even now. I think that's the implication, was that even at this point, he was trying to achieve this goal that he's still been working on now, but he and Joichiro had a falling out there. They started to have different ideals. And from what we know of Dojima, it seems as though kind of also went. I'm not super excited, honestly, to get this kind of backstory. It might be interesting, but I don't know. Joichiro has never really fascinated me as a character. I like his influence that he has on the kids, but having a backstory that applies only to him doesn't actually excite me all that much.
I can see why this is exciting for some people and why this might be the move to help kind of kick things up a notch. But at the same time, it's kind of almost, it almost feels a little more endgame than I was expecting. Like,
it really does.
You kind of felt like Azami and everything like that was kind of going to be safe for a lot longer. Now, I'm not saying Food Wars is ending or anything like that. I'm just saying it feels like that's, we've taken a large step towards that, or we're taking a large step towards that when I didn't have that impression before. And it might also just be that I'm sensitive and scared now, Nick, between Nisekoi, Bleach, and Toriko ended this year. Fairy tale looking like it's out of the way. I'm like, we can't lose everything, Nick.
No, really. I mean, if we lose Food Wars, then it's going to be like, well, shit, what are we going to talk about? My Hero Academia and Black Clover. I don't know. Have a little bit of faith, Chris. I mean, the weird guy with the white streak in his hair has taken over the school successfully. He's being expelled. So that means that the next year they're going to go into a different dimension. That's another GX reference.
Okay. I was nodding, like, yeah, I remember that scene from Rurouni Kenshin.
Honestly, though, there is obviously, a lot of weight to Azami's role in this whole thing, but I definitely don't doubt the ability of the series to move on to a different plot after he is defeated. For one thing, he might be only momentarily defeated. you know, he might try and come back with something else later on. They are, you know, only finishing up their first year at the school. And so I wouldn't be surprised if they have someone company go through all 3 years at the academy. Joining the council, if they end up doing that, might complicate matters. Because that does definitely seem like there don't seem to be too many more steps you could climb if you end up at that point. But yeah, we'll see how it goes. And I'm sure that still, even if you know this arc ends up being the last one, that probably got well over a year more of this series, I would think. Because a 5-on-5 with individual matches to knock people out, that could last a very long time.
I'm not insinuating it's ending soon. It's just a feeling I get from this that feels like a step. But what are we talking about next?
Yeah. Reluctant for it to enter the end game at all at this point. Next up, we're going to do Ole Galasso.
Oh, okay.
I don't have too much to say about this chapter. You know, Bamba is practicing with the team now. He still has no fucking idea how to play soccer because all he knows how to do is kick the ball really hard. We meet the captain of the team who is this, the guy who's described as looking very mafia-esque. He's got a very bizarre hairstyle.
He almost has my haircut, except he has less up top. You can't see it usually because I don't have like the camera with enough quality, and my hair has actually gotten a little bit long. But I do that same haircut where I shave. It's called an undercut, Nick, a slicked back undercut. He has one as well. I feel like me and him are kind of like the same way. And because they say he looks like a mafia guy, I look like a mafia guy. So
yeah,
I'm a pretty tough dude. Maybe that's why everyone's complimenting me on a cologne and ignoring my farts, because they're just like, that guy probably will have me whacked if I insult his farts and cologne.
I don't know if the hair actually has all that much to do with why people think he looks that way, Chris.
No, it's definitely just the hair. People have that same thought about me.
I think that the chiseled chin, the mean expression, and the eyebrow scar might have more to do with it.
They're like, that guy must be the consigliere of the fat white guy mafia. Just like, you got me.
The captain is introduced as being a very strong defender. And he's got puts a lot of emphasis on that. Bamba does get to show off a little bit too, because he does this ridiculous leaping overhead kick, which misses, but shows off his abilities. But the captain scolds him for it because he loses the soccer ball because it goes flying off and he has to go and find it. We get some weird, awkward fan service with the manager because the ball flips are screwed up. And then we're introduced to Ichinaro Ichino, who says that he is a genius who will teach Bamba about soccer. And this guy, I guess, is going to be our kind of deuteragonist on the soccer team.
Mm-hmm. I mean, introducing a new character, I think, at least kind of adds a bit more into the series. I do kind of like that Bamba, despite anything else, was kind of shown in this chapter to be, like, really behind the curve, because even though he has a really good shot, he is a complete newbie at everything else soccer-related, and his team's like, that's not the style we play. And I kind of like that it showed that humility in him. Like, even though his captain's able to acknowledge, like, great shot, he's like, you suck at everything else, and you're not going to get to be on the team if you suck at everything except making one crazy shot every so often.
Right. And it emphasizes the team sport aspect of it, because it seemed like in the first chapter that he was going to defy the team sport aspect of soccer, because they've made out as like, oh, you know, all these different techniques have been created in order to limit ace players, but the person who can defy all of that, you know, can score a golazo when it gets really exciting. And it seemed like he was going to go in that direction, but instead he is just showing off what he can do, and it seems like he's taking things seriously. He certainly wasn't going around being like, oh, I can't believe that Kevin doesn't admire my super shooting techniques. You know, it's like, taking it serious.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll probably only get, but I think that we'll probably only get one more chapter of this. I don't really expect it to stick around in the English jump, honestly. Because Americans don't like soccer. All right. Now we'll talk about a fairy tale.
Oh, are we? Okay. Fairy Tale, Chapter 513, Hanamaru. And in the aftermath of last week, it does seem Licarde is actually beaten. So all those things I said as to, well, we don't know whether he's beaten or not, those are true. Licarde was just as irrelevant as every other member of the Spriggan 12. He was nothing special. And maybe he'll still come back, but it felt like it was a huge waste to have him even tied to Natsu and everything like that at all. Like,
the members of the Spriggan 12 all get brought back again, so he gets brought back once, and all the ones that were defeated before get brought back a second time.
Might as well. It's not like they did anything when they came back. I guess Reinhardt got, like, powered up a little bit, and they played with that a little, but I think all those members have been probably defeated as well. I don't think they've cut back to it, but it didn't seem like, it's not like they took anyone out or did anything significant. So Kagura has a little bit of a heart-to-heart with Minerva based on the fact that they kind of had a rivalry before in the Grand Magic Games. They seem to be making up. And there's a small joke about Yukino's sister sleeping on the ground with her butt in the air. It is what it is. And Kagura looks to the air and says, "Urza, stay alive." That's when we cut over to Urza, who is beginning her fight with Irene. This is the character who has been teased over and over again as having some connection with Urza. There's been multiple theories as to what it might be, the most common one being that it's her mother, but there's also people saying it might be an alternate version of her, maybe her from the future or the past, whatever it is. There's some connection, obviously, there. And as we find out in this chapter, because a large part of it is actually just kind of action, it is the first one. This is her mother, as she reveals. She compliments her on her attack, Irene does, and afterwards says, "I am your mother." And Urza's like, "No, you're not. My parent, the only one worthy of being called my parent is the master. Only him. I was alone before." And Minerva's like, "It doesn't matter to me. I truly cannot care whether I have a daughter or not. I thought you would be long dead by now. Even if it is true, it is bad fortune to meet on the battlefield." And Urza's like, "Anyone who fights my guild is my enemy. I don't care." Irene's going to have a little bit of a toying session with her. It's like, why don't we indulge in a little bit of recollection if fate brought us here? She says, "My name is Irene Belsarian, and I was once Queen of the Dragons." So, I don't know if this is meant to imply that she actually has dragon lineage, and that means Urza would then thus have some as well, which might explain why she's so crazy strong.
She's a sword dragon slayer.
She gets wolf powers later on, just to add it. Iron dragon wolf slash power! But I honestly don't have much to say about this chapter in and of itself. This is what was expected. Like, this was the most assumed assumption with Irene's connection to whatever the character's Urza, whatever her name is. The dragon aspect of it, I guess that's something new and unexpected, but I don't know if it's necessarily going to mean anything. I mean, I just thought Licarde was going to be a big deal, so who knows if this has any relevance at all. But I guess it's something different to at least look into, but otherwise, I'm not expecting too much from this. I don't know how many times I can watch an Urza fight and not just get bored to piss, because it's just very little to get excited about at this point.
Fairy Tail is on a really weird backstory kick right now. You notice that?
Because
mm-hmm. We've got, stuff between, we had Gray take on his father, not too long. All the stuff between Xerath and Mavis was extrapolated on. Of course, Makarov was part of Mavis' backstory. Then we had that big flashback with Natsu, where it was revealed that all the Dragon Slayers once knew each other as kids. And Lucy's mother was connected to them. And of course, Lucy was also connected to Brandish.
And we got a flashback about Brandish's backstory as well.
And then we got this thing with Urza. So it's like, is every character, every important character in Fairy Tail just connected by this backstory that none of them knew about with the dragons? Because we've got Lucy is now part of it. Urza is now part of it. Then we've got Mavis and Makarov are also connected to it because of their connection to Xerath. Like all these, it's like there's suddenly this random tapestry that you didn't know about before but instead of being neatly woven together, it's just kind of like stuff's been scotch taped onto it. It's like, no, it was wonderfully crafted. Time. It's a little weird to be getting all this stuff. There's something like, oh yeah, Urza, you're part of the dragon backstory. And Lucy, you're part of the dragon backstory too. It's like, does everything have to be really... Fairy Tail wasn't always about dragons, you know?
Well, it's also that thing of, like, we have to connect. I don't know if it's necessarily what Hero's doing, but anytime it does come to that where it's like, let's connect everything together, it kind of removes a lot of the enjoyment I have for a series. Because, like, if everything has to have a connection and nothing can just be what the world naturally was, everything has to be, like, fated or foretold, then it just sounds like nothing mattered. Like, it's like everything here was kind of just wasting time.
It makes the world seem smaller because there's only one element of it that matters.
It's just like, oh, I guess Fairy Tail really wasn't that special of a guild because all of you guys were fucking fated together by dragons and shit. But, I don't know. We'll see where this goes. Again, that's all presumption on our parts right now as to whether or not that's what this, you know, revelation's supposed to be. But ultimately, I don't really care about the Irene fight. So, it's hard to get too excited. But at least, nothing god-awful happened this chapter. That's a pretty positive thing to say. We just have to accept Lacarde sucked. I want Pidgeot. Desert.
Okay. Fairy Tail is done.
I swear to God, don't say Ruby. Right.
Next is the Promised Neverland.
Phew, okay.
Alright, so last time Dawn and Gilda went into Mom's secret room, and Mom came in while they were snooping about. Of course, they were in danger of being detected. This chapter has almost nothing to do with that, honestly, because they get out of that situation pretty darn quickly. The rest of it is about tension.
To be fair, they still fuck up.
I want to bring some attention to this cover page that we get. Promise Neverland getting a lot of really good color pages, but it's a Christmas page, and everyone's looking so happy.
Well, except Ray. He looks like he just stole that Christmas gift and he's, like, mocking it. Like, he's just like, I took this from a child. I'm like, you're still a child.
There's a disembodied head in this box. It's so weird to see this. There's, like, no nefarious, evil things in this, picture.
Who's Santa? Is that Minerva, I guess? Yeah, I guess it's Minerva. That's
William Minerva.
Yeah. So I was gonna say maybe like it'd be so fucked up if the Santa Claus was fucking a demon. Just like
the reindeer are skeletal.
Flying towards the children with like a bib on and a fork and knife in hand.
But no, it's just people celebrating Christmas on a Christmas tree. And look, Mom's there and she's serving food. And there's no crone, otherwise she would creep up this picture.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's weird because, like, I'm so used to just, you know, something to these cover pages looking ominous and terrifying. It's just like, oh, they look happy.
I guess there is some good in this world.
I don't trust this. Anyway. Dawn and Gilda get out. They leave the room. They don't get caught. They're fine. that happens in, like, 2 pages, honestly. And then we cut back to the library, or not the library, but to Emma and the others leaving the library. And Norman says, and Ray are like, oh, I can't believe that you discovered that detail with the nameplates. Emma actually says, I didn't actually notice them. Phil found them and told me about them.
Fucking Phil.
Phil. And he just, you know, at one point pointed out the thing and said, oh, look, this says run in Morse code. And so I decided to look at the other ones that were by William Minerva. And Ray makes the comment, huh, now that makes sense. And it was like, wait, what does that mean? they seem to be kind of playing up on this Phil kid being one of the more intelligent ones, not in their group. You know, after the whole, they point out that his test scores were rising. So I guess there's possible that they'll add him into the dynamic. It'd be kind of interesting to have a younger kid. Because Don and Gilda and Emma and Norman and Ray are all pretty much around the same age, but Phil is just like, little kid. So.
He's exactly that kind of little kid.
Yeah. The one that goes, ah! Emma gets freaked out because she realizes that Dawn and Gilda are not there when they go for dinner, so they're looking around trying to find they're okay because they managed to drop off the keys somewhere, and one of the other kids finds it and just brings and is like, "I found this, Mom." She of course realizes like, "When did the key go missing?" But she doesn't know for sure that it was actually swept from her. So it seems that Don did manage to get away. They meet up with Emma and company again, and after dinner is done, they have a bit of privacy. Emma freaks out because they went into the secret room, and Ray is scolding them because they acted unnecessarily, but Don is pretty frickin' pissed off because they know that they've been lied to now. Don starts getting really upset because they know that they can't go and help and save Connie and the rest of them. This was kind of a bluff on his part, because Emma immediately apologizes instead of continuing to deny things. And Don stops freaking out and he's like, "I told you, Gilda." And he starts getting pissed off again. So they're at this point forced to just tell them the actual truth about the demon farm. And Gilda's like, "Jesus Christ, what the fuck is up?" Don is in denial for a moment. Then he gets really violent. He punches Norman. He punches Ray. And he goes for Emma. And Emma just kind of braces herself for it. She doesn't do anything. She just goes limp and closes her eyes and braces for impact. And Don lets her go and starts to cry because he realizes that he thinks that Emma and thought of he and Gilda as a burden, as being weak and useless and needing to be protected. And Gilda comes to the revelation that because she had been in denial that Emma could possibly lie to them about something, she understands that she did tell them a cruel lie, but lied to protect them. So, Emma feels pretty guilty about all of this because even though she was doing this to protect them, this demonstrates that she didn't have any faith in them, any faith in their abilities, and felt that they were, you know, people to be protected instead of people to be trusted and worthy. So Don and Gilda go off, and then the rest are kind of like,
that went awkwardly.
That was awkward. Yeah. And Gilda catches up with Don and says that he's not actually really angry with the three of them. He's more angry at himself. He's frustrated that they saw that he couldn't really do anything, and so because of that, they had to lie and protect him. And he's really just full-on bawling at that point. So frustrated. Emma goes out from Ray and Norman to apologize to Don Gilda, and she wants to bring them into the fold fully now, and she says, like, "Yeah, I was wrong. I was naive to actually believe that, to believe we can do this without them. And now I know that this is how we can escape with everyone. I know the way that we can do this, so I won't make another mistake unless we're going to get them." But we cut over to Crone, looking all horror monster through a window.
Yeah. At first, I didn't quite understand it, but
he's just kind of going,
"Yeah." And I guess she's been listening in on that entire conversation.
Yeah. So,
it's hard to tell.
She was looking. She's looking in the window into the room they were having this conversation in. So yeah, she's seen the entire conversation that she's been having. Now she knows everyone that is aware of the situation. That we're probably moving towards the point where Crone is actually going to take actions against them. Which means, of course, that she's probably not too much longer for this series.
we shall see.
You know, I've just got that thing going. It's like, there is no way that she's going to be able to do anything. So literally, whenever she actually takes action, that's when she's going to, you know, get out. She's going to be gone.
We'll see. I think there may still be... I don't think she'll succeed in anything, but I don't think Crone's going to be completely... I think she's got enough intelligence to her that she's going to make a difference in things, however that may be. But, really good chapter.
To pick up now. Yeah, things are starting to pick up now that everyone who's actually working together is in on the secret. So, but yeah, it was also a really cool chapter, and it kind of took a bit of an unexpected turn in terms of the way that Dawn and Gilda reacted to the news. A lot less focus on what do you mean demons are going to eat us, and a lot more on trust issues.
Yeah, I like seeing them go through that too. It's some good development for Dawn. It's to the point now where I'm like, I hope he doesn't just get like eaten by a monster or something like that. It's like a, hey, you do this character kind of sacrifice. I like the guy now.
Really enjoying the way that trust is playing in as a big theme in the series. You know, Rey told Norman and Emma that they shouldn't trust anyone. Of course, part of it was the fact that he was actually a traitor with his own agenda. But then because they didn't trust their friends fully, this situation came about and Dawn and Gilda put themselves in danger when maybe they wouldn't have if they actually knew the full truth. So, and also, they're putting a lot of trust in a complete stranger who...
Yes.
Alright, so that's done. So move on now to One Piece.
Oh. Okay.
One Piece, chapter 848, Goodbye. This was a bit of a weird one.
I like the cover page. I just want to note the cover page first off, because everyone are in these bright red jackets, like full-length jackets, and it's a very striking shade of red. It's a really cool visual. I like seeing it, how them and all the bears.
Mostly white background.
Yeah, it stands out very well. It's a really, really nice visual.
Also, it's kind of like an older kind of art style way that the cover.
Yeah, well, it's the colors almost seem kind of faded, essentially. So it helps the red strike out even more.
Also, Chopper is riding on a giant smoking teddy.
Yeah, he is doing that. Holy shit, I didn't realize that fucking bear's token up.
Yeah.
That bear's high as shit.
Giant marijuana teddy bear. Straw hat.
The bear's like, yo, I see a fucking giant skeleton and a robot and a reindeer. This shit's amazing. Like, you're a giant teddy bear. Oh, fuck, man. I think I took too much.
We kind of continue on with all of the multiple confrontations that happened in the last chapter. Big Mom has just hung up on Luffy and Nami in their cell. And we're introduced to Angeles, who is a tiny Yankee with a pompadour, who is riding on, I don't know what this is. It's like
a
caterpillar that he is riding like a motorcycle.
Obviously. What else would it be? Yo, coming through, coming through! We got an infiltrator in the treasure room! Oh, hang on, sorry. A Ninfilrator! Ninfilrator! I don't know why the fuck he missed this infiltrator that badly, but it's interesting.
Well, it's only little, you know. Yeah, so Big Mom is like, oh, Big Mom is not concerned whatsoever with Luffy getting angry at her. She's just like, whatever. I'll kick his ass. Anyway, I've also got this awesome wedding coming up too, so why should I bother being angry? You know, I've got a great weekend. But then she hears the news about the infiltrator, and then she gets really pissed off and she says, "They better not be after my Tamante bar!" We cut over to Sanji's guest room, and, so he's got some conflicting emotions going on. He's obviously really upset about his crew, but he's thinking, but you know, if I just go through with this whole thing, then she'll let the crew go. And also, I've got pudding here. I will make her happy. And he's got hearts flowing out of his eyes. So a little bit more of the old Sanji kind of sticking its head out now that things are not looking so bleak for him, which might lend a little bit of credence to your theories on pudding.
This chapter very clearly put a kibosh to that.
Well, who knows, honestly.
At least my idea, it seems to very clearly have been stomped all over.
We'll see. We'll see. We also cut over to Pudding's room, and she has just heard news from a servant about Lola's Viver card, the one that she gave to Nami. So she hears about this, and she kind of just ignores all the stuff that the servant is saying, and she instead has a flashback to a couple of conversations, one that she had with Big Mom, which was, do as I say, and your life will go smoothly. And then another one, which she had with Lola, which is kind of cute to see. I like seeing this. I mean, it's a weird thing to realize that, yeah, Big Mom's had so many kids that there is this weird age difference between them, because there are just so damn many of them. But, you know, we've got this tiny little Pudding with a somewhat young Lola. But Lola said, there's no way that Big Mom would be killing this mother and daughter, so I'm going to go out on my own and pick up my own husband. So just thinking of the... Which, of course, is different from what Big Mom actually thinks about the whole situation. So Pudding is just considering this as we then cut away to where Pedro, the infiltrator, is fighting with this assortment of guards and running through them, just causing general mayhem. He's using explosions, he's fighting them while running away. Having a bit of a hard time because you can see that he is breathing and grunting heavily while making his way away from them, but what he's just trying to do is just occupy them as much as he can. Baron Tamago gets an update about the infiltrator's progress. He's near the courtyard on the third floor of the Red Bean Baumcake.
Corner him in the Jordan. S.L. Vals Plate.
Yes.
General Smoothie?
You were right. There's another one. Yours is a decoy.
I see. Pedro, you conniver.
Should we keep on going? He's
got more. Oh, did he say more? I thought
he's got more. They slipped past us into the treasure repository, then locked the doors. I'm sorry, we got sloppy.
I see. Well, the Chambre D treasure has only one door, in or out.
We need water.
As long as you hold firm there, nothing is Rooney.
Nothing is Rooney. Good point. We'll do that. If he defeats the guards inside and then comes through the door, we'll kill him. Is that cool?
If it's who I think it is, he's Lee Bones, one of the freaks Mama Desiree's. So half kill only. Wheeze, wheeze.
You don't even need to change the pronunciation of that one. Half kill already sounds weird.
Yeah, so only half killer. Only. And say hi to your mother for me.
So yes, we cut to inside of the treasure repository, where Brooke is encountering what remaining guards there are. And he's, of course, very happy because there are only much fewer of them. So they move forward and attack him, and Brooke goes over the fact that the only soldiers that are actually inside the room are chess peacekeepers, soldiers with human souls inserted into them through Big Mom's powers. Which means you are moved by your souls! And he takes out his guitar. They quickly engage on him, and he's like, oh, come on, I gotta tune my... Stop it! Wait for me, baby! And then he starts playing his guitar, and it's this really badass panel where he's just playing while this giant, ghostly image appears behind him, and all of the soldiers start to fall over, and because they're in the presence of the Soul King, and your lazy, slapped-on little souls cannot stay on their feet in the presence of my soul scream! It's so badass.
It's really cool, because Brooke hasn't had a cool moment like that, and seeing, like, the visual of, like, the Soul King floating above Brooke with, like, its ominous, like, looming presence is pretty cool. I actually, someone brought up in the chat, I hadn't considered before, what would Big Mom's power do in reference to Brooke?
Yeah.
Because Big Mom also has a soul fruit of a kind, so it'd be kind of interesting to see how that interaction plays at all. But, yeah, Brooke finally gets to show off and do an attack that isn't just like, I make ice now for some reason. Like, it's like, oh, here's what his power set could be like now. So that's pretty interesting and cool to see. Fortunately, I think that's all of this week.
Yep, that's, yeah. We cut to the prison library again, where Pudding has arrived. And she asks to talk with Luffy and Nami again. They're like, yeah, okay. But they allow her to go into the cell to speak with them privately, and she starts to whisper with them. We cut away, actually briefly, to see Sanji just kind of like happily picking flowers, like, I'm gonna make Pudding happy. Pudding says to them, yeah, Sanji proposed to me. And she says, it was a wonderful feeling, but I know he's just being considerate of me. My presence here is causing pain to everyone. So don't worry, I'm not going to marry him. And Nami and Luffy are just like, whoa. And Pudding starts to whisper something to both of them, which we don't get to hear, but it shocks the hell out of both of them. And Luffy starts freaking out, before Pudding, you know, starts to walk away, and she turns to look over their shoulder and she's crying and she just says goodbye. And that's it, that's the end of the chapter. I mean, you could easily interpret this in a couple of different ways. The way that I think that we're meant to interpret it is that Pudding is intending to kill herself in order to get Sanji out of this situation without, of course, forcing him to... Because if he breaks, of course, the marriage, then of course there'd be consequences, but if she dies before he can marry her, well, that's not his fault.
Yeah.
But the idea did occur to me, because you put this idea out there, the Pudding is manipulating stuff, that maybe she's revealed her evil plan to them, and that's why they're freaking out. I don't know about that, though.
This, to me, like, when I read it, I was like, oh, so she's not evil, and I look like a fucking fool.
It's still a possibility, but I think that the chances went down.
I think it's just now a coincidence that... I think it's just a coincidence now that her romantic fling with Sanji's kind of just resulted in him kind of letting bygones be bygones here. And I don't know. Something will happen, I'm sure. The next few chapters will probably reveal some pretty big things and start setting things into motion, because I believe it was confirmed that the Wano arc is supposed to start next year. So sometime in the next 12 months, this thing ends. Yeah.
It might be just... hightailing it the fuck out of here, as opposed to actually having to get an actual confrontation with Big Mom.
Which makes sense. I mean, she's one of the four emperors. I'd imagine that...
A little bit early for her, yeah. So,
or even then, that it would be a short arc.
They'll probably just end up fighting their way out.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's one piece.
An interesting chapter, a cool moment, and some intriguing stuff, I think. If she does end up going against Big Mom at this point, I like the fact that they touched on her relationship with Lola a little bit, because it seems to, it would then break from the more cliched, oh, she fell in love with this guy, and so she's going to do stuff for him. Alright, that one is in the books, so next we'll move on to Ruby.
Okay. So we need to get that one out of the way here. Alright, so Ruby, chapter 6. And there's not actually a whole lot to say about this one, because this chapter is almost entirely action. But there is something at the start about how the world is separated to two people. Humanoid people and the Faunus, which I guess are the kind of animal-like people. I guess I didn't realize this before, but Blake must be one of them, because she almost was like fox ears. I just assumed that was like a weeaboo thing. I didn't think anything of it. But,
is that not a bow?
It might be I think they're actually supposed to be ears. I mean, why would they make a point about her being a faunus? Yeah, I think they're ears. I don't know. I'm going to get 1,000 fucking emails about this if I say they are or aren't, so I don't know. So they make mention that there was a war between the humans and the Faunus because of their differences, but a peace was established, and it's still like an unsteady peace where some humans consider Faunus lower beings than them, etc.
That's a bow, Chris.
Well, fucking, hold on. She has ears under the bow, and the bow comes off at the end. There you go, alright? One of the Faunus protest organizations, White Fang, sought peaceful coexistence. They want no bloodshed. At least that's how it was at the beginning. And lo and behold, Blake belongs to White Fang. So the next, like, 10 fucking pages are just basically action. There's a little bit of, like, mid-action banter, but nothing of any real significance. They destroy the giant robot. And I don't know if there was supposed to be a person in there, because Adam okay, yeah, there is somebody who comes out at the very end, and Adam cuts his arm off. Although, it doesn't look like blood comes out, so that might have also just been a smaller robot controlling the big one. The only reason why I bring it up is because Blake ends it by being like, "That was sloppy." He's like, "Don't worry, that's why you're here." She's like, "Not anymore. Adam, it's important that White Fang doesn't lower themselves to bloodshed. Goodbye." And I'm like, I guess if that was a person and she was like, "You killed a man and I won't be a part of that," it would make sense. Although she doesn't really have like a mortified reaction to that. It's very like, "You fucked up. This group sucks. Get good," and then just leaves or something like that. It feels like someone like leaving like a raid group at WoW or something like that, not like a "you betrayed all of our morals" thing. But that's how the chapter ends. There's really not a whole lot of like substance to this chapter. It's a lot of action, and it's some decent action. Like the artwork within Ruby has been pretty good recently, but I still don't have a very good idea of who Blake is at this point, or what the narrative they're going with right now is either.
I do want to note, because I kind of followed along in the chapter a bit while you were going through that, Blake's design, I fucking hate it.
Why do you hate it, Nick?
Well, it's mostly the pants, because she's got like, they're like designed to look like stockings and garters, but the garters are like part of the pants.
Okay.
It's really weird.
Is that your one complaint?
It's like someone wanted to do like a goth Lolita thing, but also wanted it to make sense for someone going into combat, and of course the two are so horrifically contrasting that it doesn't work. So.
Well, of course, it's another character who's like, my whole thing is like high speed battle and fighting, and I wear high heels into combat, so.
Right.
Yeah, have that going for it, but
the bow that goes over my ears somehow.
Yeah, disguising the hat bow. All
right. Okay, then with that one done, next is gonna be Black Clover.
Oh, okay.
Black Clover. Let's get a spell to it.
It's 89. Defector's Atonement.
Defector's Atonement. Have you read the Black Clover novel yet?
You know what? At this point, fuck it. I don't even want to hear about the novel. They're essentially just giving us the novel at this point. They're like, yeah, I know we didn't explain all this stuff, but fuck it. We'll just give you enough of it now that you have the story anyway from here, or at least most of it. So shut up. Just deal with it. You're getting 8 chapters of this dude. He's a big goddamn deal.
So there's Fanzel, this wind sword guy who previously was part of the Diamond Kingdom. Was the teacher for the elite soldiers who he's facing off against now. Guy with weird smile just says everything. It's like, here is all the information that all three of us already know, but I'm just gonna say it anyway. This clumsy goddamn exposition. He explains that their king is sick, and that the queen has been alive for hundreds of years, therefore they want the secret of her life, even if they have to kill everyone. That's the way we do it in the Diamond Kingdom, remember? That's our gimmick. We're ruthless. Yeah.
We're the evil kingdom. Like, something tells me something tells me the other two are pretty evil, too.
Fanzel engages with the army. And one of the enemy soldiers has time to shout, "It's Fanzel Kruger, the traitor, the scum!"
Like, they have time to get through his entire backstory.
So clumsy.
It's Fandral Kruger, the traitor, the man who has wind magic. Met Asta at one point, was ready to give up on life, but Asta convinced him to keep going, and thus he's continued to elude us, but fight back against us as opposed to solely running. He has a bounty. Everyone, we should get him.
God.
And he just goes through, he's like, wind speed, and boom, 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 boom. All these dudes fucking shouting exposition. That's Fandral.
They try and gang up on him, but short, dark-haired girl
now, Nick,
shows up.
She's very important, because as we find,
she's very important. She's
a former
assassin. She's just as important as Rebecca. Oh, God. She says... She suddenly surprises them. I guess she has gathered all the witches together to lead a counterattack. And she says something that I think is very strange, which is, when mounting a surprise attack, be sure you have more than 3 times your enemy's military strength. That is what my teacher taught me. That is a shit lesson. Surprises can be used to overturn a situation when you have
inferior military
strength.
Why would you want 3 times the size for a surprise attack?
3 times!
Isn't that, like, gonna be easier for the enemy army to spot an army 3 times their size coming at them? Like, I know you can hide, but...
Fucking shit military tactics by this dumb teacher.
Well, it's just like, I mean, the logic's there, but why are you surprise attack? I can understand why you would, but it's just, I feel like the opportunity to surprise attack when you have 3 times the number of forces generally isn't the situation when that comes up. Normally you have to rely on surprise tactics when you don't have the numbers advantage on your
have
side.
Have you ever heard of guerrilla warfare? Which is when you surprise attack somebody and then run away specifically because you have inferior military strength. Like,
and did they? Hold on. It seems like they're pretty even in numbers, actually.
Like, it doesn't make sense!
That's so
Alright.
They're about even. In those 2 pages, the people they knock out of the air and the witches we see behind her, they're about even in number.
Also, she's an assassin, I guess. Yeah. She leads a number of formations and stuff, and she takes out one of the, I guess, captains of the Diamond Army. She says, you know what you do when you're an assassin, Chris?
Wait.
You stealthed? Go ahead.
That was one of the fucking Diamond King and generals?
I don't know if it was actually one of their actual Diamond
soldiers. Oh, okay.
He's
really
leading the other troops.
I was going to be fucking infuriated. I was like, you did a big fucking deal about, like, the 7 new real Diamond generals. You took one of them out to this fucking assassin chick to a rock?
I don't know. He's got one of the furry coats. He might be.
I'd be fucking infuriated if they did. Like, what was the point of that? The Spriggan 12 all over again. What did he do?
So, this girl is like, I was part of the Diamond King's assassination unit, and you people are too easy for me. While she's sneaking up behind him, and then she goes on to, like, and then she, like, has this whole monologue, inner monologue as well. It's like, you're an assassin. Take him out before you tell him all of this stuff. And she explains, once I killed people who were doing everything they could to live, so that I myself could live, may not be able to atone for it, no matter what I do. This may be mere self-satisfaction. Putting a stop to your tyranny. That's how I'll atone. No matter what you say to me, I won't lose heart anymore. If I did, the person who saved me would get angry with me again. And you can read all about the story of how he saved me.
I'm like sitting there, I'm like, who are you? I mean, yes, of course you're one of the 19,000 characters whose entire motivation to get better in life was solely inspired by Asta. I could imagine that story. But who are you? I know you explain all to be here, but I'm still sitting here like, I don't know who you are. Even, like, within the context of we just introduced these characters, I was like, well, there's the dude who gets naked, the dude who gets naked's wife, who's a witch, and then third person. You're third person. What's your name? Did they say her name anywhere?
I don't think so in this chapter. The girl...
Mariella. Mariella. They do say her name a little bit.
The witch, by the way, who is who is obsessed with money. She's like my favorite character in this trio, just specifically because she doesn't get a what Asta means to me flashback in this chapter. So I'm just like, okay, you get a pass. You get a pass. Your whole thing with your obsession with your obsession with money is linked into your magical abilities. That's fine with me. Also, you use a golem that exploded. That's kind of cool. I'll take it. And then we cut back to the main fight and a flashback about how Asta is important and how he convinced my final student, your junior apprentice, I promised him that I'm going to live and I wouldn't run anymore. Right. And Annalise isn't here this week in order to scold us for not liking
it. Yeah, you're like, Nick, get all your anger out now. Here's the thing.
I'll hate people liking Asta as much as I want now.
No one's here to stop you. I don't mind the stuff with Fafroll or whatever the fuck his stupid name is. It's like, at this point, I'm kind of just whatever. It's just to the point where I'm like, I don't know why it's that important to get to this, because it's not like this is anything new. As a reader, like, we haven't...
Fanzel, by the way.
Yeah, we haven't seen this story before, except we have with every single character before this. And this is a story where we didn't even actually get the reason why. Like, we get a flashback to it, but we still don't know any of the context, really. He betrayed the generals and ran away, but Asta convinced him to stop running and fight. In some situation, the details of which we aren't privy to unless you read the Black Novel. Fucking light novel, so... Be that as it may, we've gotten enough detail that I could at least, like, digest what he's doing. But then it's the need to have the other fucking character show up and be like, and I also was inspired by Asta and changed my ways and must atone for my... It's just like, I don't care! Who are any of you people? And fuck off, actually! Because I don't care about these 17 fucking backstories of characters who have shown up out of nowhere, have apparently had a long fucking relationship with Asta that's very relevant, buy the novel, $14.99 online or whatever, and then it's like, jump back to the other stuff that's already the same shit we've gotten before. Like, I'm like, either move on from this arc or do something new, because at this point I'm bored out of my mind every week with Black Clover.
It was just... First off, there's the weird exposition in it that is just... It's blatant. But if you get beyond that, because that happens in manga and comics all the frickin' time, especially with stuff that's like, okay, we have to reference something that hasn't actually happened in the manga in order to fill in some gaps. Whatever, that's inevitable. But yeah, the fact that you then have to go backwards and start over after we were kind of getting to a point with fans where we're just like, okay, we're past all the explanation, they can just fight now. Like, no, I have to also tell you about my backstory. Ah!
It's like, if I have to fucking find out what this other chick fucking did and Asta fucking pulled her aside and turned her on the right path, it's just like, I just want to just deal with the shit with Fauna, whatever her name is, handle the stuff with Mars, and let's just move on to another arc. Because this one is just... It's dragging on too long, and it's not even been a long arc, but every chapter recently has felt like more of the same or just an annoyance. I'm sorry, Annalise.
Did we want to talk Eden's plan?
Yeah, we can bring it up. We haven't mentioned much of it. We didn't even talk about it last week, but this is the last week it's going to be in the magazine, so might be worth it to mention at least a bit about it.
In short, basically what happens is that Bolo, of course, is looking for Carlos. That seems to be something that's going to be happening for a while. He's on the lookout for him, and of course on the lookout for Patron, who stole him away after graduating. He ends up hearing from somebody that there is an information broker that he could find in essentially an underground bar, but it's a super fancy underground bar with, like, there's just a piano set up next to this very elegant staircase. It's really super odd because it's first made out like it's going to be this seedy place that's, you know, kept in secret that only the underworld knows about. And then there's fancy people in double-breasted coats going around, like, oh, yes, this is quite nice. Especially weird for, you know, someone who's a, you know, seedy information broker to be there. The information broker is a girl. Very pretty young lady that was like, and he's like, I need you to help me find my friend Carlos. Okay, I'll help you find him for $200,000, basically. He's like, what? And of course, he has no money. She ends up saying, like, oh, yeah, my success rate for finding missing people is 80%. You'll probably actually wind up paying at least $500,000. So he just prostrates himself before her, bows, is like, please, I don't have any money. I don't have it right now. I'll find a way to actually get it, but I need your help right now. She's like, no. This is disgusting, you know, the fact that you would approach him with that kind of attitude. And she has him thrown out and says, don't approach me again. She ends up running into him when she goes out of the bar because he's waited there for her. Her name is Salvia, by the way. He begs her again and she's like, I'm going to have you arrested for sexual harassment if you try and grab my shoulder again. She says, if you can't find this person is really that important to you, you shouldn't entrust someone else with the tab. Do it yourself. After she has mysteriously disappeared around a corner, which isn't exactly explained, it's possible it has something to do with her pocket watch. I'm not sure. But Bolo ends up getting jumped by some other guys while she's watching him curiously from the rooftops. They try to mug him. And he ends up fending them off with his demon powers. And so this seems to pique Sylvia's curiosity, Salvia's curiosity. Turns out the goons that jumped Bolo end up getting attacked by a patron and a minion of patrons who also has demonic powers. His head explodes. Head blown, hole blown through his skull by something that seemed to come from the guy's hand. But yeah, patron is still apparently watching Bolo from the shadows as well.
I actually like Demon's Plan. And this chapter was kind of interesting in a way. I wish I had more of the frame of mind to focus on it the past 2 weeks we've been going through. It's unfortunately just been one of the things I've always a casualty of, like, lack of sleep or a lack of time to really sit through and digest all of it. But I've been hearing really good things about it, especially from, like, you know, people on the Jump podcast really enjoy it. So it's one of the series that could have a lot of potential, the art style, and it's a bit unique, and it does feel slightly different. You know, I do like stories of, like, the main character traveling, so you feel like you're going to different places, helps the world feel a little bit larger. I don't know if it's going to stick around. I don't know if it's going to stick around in Jump or even, you know, in the U.S. Jump. But, you know, I think I was glad at the very least to get this little glimpse at it. It seemed like a fun little world. And this was a nice little... This isn't the best chapter to end on, but it's still like a chapter, you know, like good to have it.
Yeah. And you never know what series you're going to make it.
Yeah. So. Fucking Straighten Up's still going.
Heck, he doesn't know Yabo.
Yeah.
So we want to finish up with My Hero Academia, then. Number 118, Meaningless Battles. Yes, yes, it's time for My Hero Academia, yes.
That's your My Hero Academia alert.
Eraserhead receives word that people are fighting at Ground Beta as Midoriya and Bakugo are now engaged in battle. He heads outside, but he's suddenly caught by a shadowy figure who is seemingly trying to get in his way. I would guess it might be All Might. Yeah, Bakugo and Midoriya are fighting. Deku, of course, is trying to beg off and saying, like, well, why do we have to fight? What are you doing? The fact that this happened doesn't mean that you were wrong about anything. Nobody ever said that you looking up to him was wrong. Bakugo, however, is just thinking about their shared past together, about all the times that he would pick on Deku or leave Deku in the dust, but even so, no matter how many times he bullied him or left him behind, Deku was always there following after him. Also, of course, they shared the fact that they looked up to All Might as well.
I'm actually kind of curious who that person is at Stops Aizawa, because you say All Might, but I'm wondering if it might not actually be him, but maybe...
He seems quite shocked to see him, so who knows.
Maybe one of the students? I'm trying to think, like, who did we see not sleeping? Like, I don't think we saw Uraraka. We didn't see her. Could be her. Could be,
The ones we saw were Kirishima, Ida, Yayorozu, Todoroki.
And Todoroki. I think those are it. So it could be any one of the other students.
Well, it wouldn't be Hagakure, because...
Yeah, that'd be weird. But, yeah, I'm just sitting
there...
Unless
she's, like, wearing a full body suit so that he will see her. It's too tall to be Mineta.
Could be Gang Orca. He's like, I'm a major character now!
I'm going to keep on showing up because I'm that awesome.
I'm so pimp.
There's a flashback we get to All Might speaking with Bakugo during the test battle. Telling him, of course, that, you know, you've got the makings of the pro, but I know you're freaking out about Midoriya's incredible growth, but when he starts at level 1 and you're at level 50, naturally you'll be growing at different rates. And, of course, Bakugo is still fighting with Deku. He gets in a good kick and then tries to hit him with an explosion while Deku is stunned. And Deku manages to backflip out of the way, knock the explosion away. And when Bakugo gets knocked on his ass as a result of this, Deku, you know, just as the same as always as he is with Bakugo, he extends a hand out to help him. And Bakugo just lashes out at him, knocks his hand away, and says, stop worrying about me, just fight, what the hell? How'd I end up chasing after a dweeb who was always playing catch-up? Why did a twerp like you get that kind of power? You got All Might to recognize you. You got way stronger. So why was it me? Why was it me who put an end to All Might? And things kind of just kind of come crumbling apart for him. He just kind of starts letting stuff out after that. Points. And it turns out this wasn't really about Deku, this whole freak out. He just is blaming himself for the fact that All Might had to come and save him. You know, he says, you know, if I had been stronger, if I hadn't been kidnapped by those villains, then everything would be fine. All Might's been trying to keep it a secret himself. He hasn't told anyone, but even if I try to forget, it all just comes rushing back. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. So, he blames himself for the fact that All Might's gone now. And, yeah. That kind of sucks.
This makes... One, this is a great change for the character. And two, it makes a lot of sense. Bakugo's always been kind of characterized by one thing. Anger. He's a very angry kid. He uses that in fights to good effect with his power, but... You know, we mentioned before, it's also like a joke for him. Like, he's so angry when he's brushing his teeth, he's like screaming, die, plaque, die. This is a kid with so much anger that when he's faced with an emotion that isn't angry, he doesn't really know how to process it. So he's going through grief and then issues with his own, you know, abilities and his own weaknesses. And he doesn't know how to handle them, so he's just releasing it in the only way he knows how, which is anger. And that's, you know, manifested in this fight with Deku. It's a violent way of him trying to deal with his own insecurities and shortcomings. And it's interesting because what happens basically right after this is Deku realizes that's kind of what's happening as well. And that it's not really a fight to see who's a winner or a loser. It's that they have to, it's the only way they can kind of express their own emotions. At least
only when our fists clash against each other can we truly connect.
It's an absurdly, like, male, macho, shonen sort of sentiment, but it's being done relatively, like, really well. Like, it's always stupid and silly when it happens, but it's still cool in the same way. Like, the only way these two, you know, rivals and people who have had such conflicted feelings with one another can truly understand each other is through the heat and passion of battle. Like, it's the bonds of friendship will be formed by our muscles and fists, so... It's kind of fun in that way.
And Deku just decides that he's got to get serious. That the only way for Bakugo to deal with this whole thing is if they just fight. Because the only one who understood what Kachan was feeling was me.
Yeah, and this is something that I think can definitely lead to some unique changes. I wouldn't expect Bakugo to change overnight, but this might be the start of a Bakugo that has either more respect for Deku, or is at least more willing to be cooperative with him. I feel like there's going to be a positive change as the outcome of this. And that's maybe why the individual who's stopping Aizawa is doing so, because they can see this is probably a good thing for both of them. I like this chapter a lot.
Yeah. I really liked it. It took a bit of a direction that I wasn't really expecting. It makes me feel more sympathy for Bakugo than, you know, just insecurity about not being stronger than Deku would have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously he was frustrated about that, but the thing that actually is causing him pain is that he feels like that seeming weakness has caused this thing to happen, his hero to be vanquished. But he's not very emotionally mature, so the only thing he knows...
Yeah, well, he just pouts and blows things up, yep. All right, that's going to do it.
Yeah, so we are going to wrap things up there. Thank you guys for joining us here on hitbox.tv/reality or twitch.tv/reality.
Yeah,
we do the show. We do the show Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, although sometimes we do need to change things up. So to stay updated, be sure to follow us on Twitter. You can follow the podcast at WMR Podcast, and you can follow us individually at Reality at YRuler Time. You can also check out all of our past episodes and weekly manga recap at podbean.com. Also on YouTube, youtube.com/weeklymangarecap, and on iTunes as well. So also subscribe, leave a comment, leave a rating, and help us to meet any woodworkers in the hobby section.
Yes, we need it. It's the only Christmas gift I want, guys. My birthday is this Monday. It'd be great if on the next episode I could read the greatest gift of all. Couple iTunes reviews, 5 stars. It'd be really mean if you made them and you're just all 1 star. So you're like, go fuck yourself, Chris. I'm like, oh, it's just like every birthday before this. But no, it helps us out, guys. It's something that helps give the podcast more visibility. We can find new people and, you know, it helps the show grow. So 5-star reviews are, you know, huge and important.
Yeah, and you can also send us stuff to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com, ask us questions, provide feedback on the show, and of course suggest future manga for us to read. Always use suggestions like that.
Especially actually, this is a good time for people who have sent some in the past to send them in again, because we've gotten a lot of questions and things like that in the past couple of weeks, but I feel like people haven't sent in recommendations for a while, so if you haven't sent yours in a while, it might be a good time to send them back in again. Just as a way to refresh us on it, because we don't always go back like 8 or so months when we're looking for recommendations or whatever. So feel free to send in. It could be the exact same thing as before. Just send in again helps us remind us of it, essentially.
Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to do all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. The bonus episode that Chris mentioned earlier. Yeah, look forward to our special December.
Yes, and by the way, if you missed the last Digimon commentary we did, it's up on Patreon right now. You don't need to be a patron to get it. You don't even need to have a Patreon account. It's just on there for everybody to grab. We're basically just hosting it there. And we'll actually have the commentary track we did for Appleseed up on there probably within the next couple days or so. So, again, all free. Just run up there and grab it.
And lastly, special thanks go out to Infamous Planet, helps us put the podcast together, and to Steve Mann, our title cardist, who drew flying butts for us this week.
I have to imagine, because I completely, like, neglected to mention that we were doing this for him until, like, this weekend. Like, it just slipped my mind because he did the JoJo one, and we didn't know the series, and I just forgot to mention it in the meantime. I assumed it would be, like, him rushing. I feel like he got this, and he was just like, oh, this is perfect. I can do this while I'm working on other art I'm doing. Like, it's just so natural of him. I was like, I'm just going to start drawing butts on this and put a WMR over it. It's an awesome title card, but yeah, great work for Steve, man.
And yeah, that's going to do it. So, Chris, do you have a suggestion for us?
I do. Actually, before I get to the suggestion, I just want to mention this real quick. I talked about in the show a long time ago that there's a One Piece RPG that I I helped make, and it's still out there. It's still going strong, actually, and it's going so strong they just unlocked the Grand Line. When it started, it was just the four blues with various islands. They've now opened up the Grand Line, so anybody who's playing there can progress to that point and go into the Grand Line to basically have their own One Piece-style adventure going to all these islands and having adventures with the crew. So if you're interested in checking it out, it's, you know, it's all free. It's run by people who are fans of Weekly Manga Recap and everything like that. It's odar.conforms.com, and you can check it out there. It's a lot of fun. Everybody's on there really, you know, there's all talent levels, but everybody on there is awesome. That's the one consistent thing among it, is everyone there is a very cool person. And if you aren't even a writer, you just want to go and read stories, or if you just want to go and talk about, like, anime and manga or off-topic things with fans of the podcast, it's a great place to go. It's kind of like the unofficial Weekly Manga Recap forum. So just check that out. And then, yes, I do have a suggestion. This one I'm taking from, I don't know how to fucking pronounce this name. I feel like it's just letters typed together, but I know I'm going to offend that person if I assume that. I'm going to give this a try, but bear with me on this. Hashkandunkhan? I want to note, in the middle of this, there's an S-H-Z-H-K-H. Just in a row. I don't know how to pronounce that. I tried. But the series we're going to take a look at is called Skill of Lore. And this is a callback to, I guess at one point, Nick, a very long time ago, you made reference to wanting to see a manga about a pickup artist. Well, apparently that's what this is about. It's about a guy who is cursed with the gift to turn any interaction with a woman into a sexual harassment charge. So it's apparently, though, actually a little edgy, but I think it actually does rope around to become something heartwarming. So
we're gonna take a webtoon.
It's also I believe a manhwa. So
yeah,
we're gonna have something a little bit different. I don't know if we're gonna get to it next week, but perhaps the week after that. We actually might actually have a special guest next week too. If we do, I'll announce it ahead of time. But yeah, we're gonna take a look at that, and should get this one out at the end of the year. I think though, I think we're gonna have 2 weeks before the jump starts, like, coming out, like, the holiday break. I don't know exactly what weeks that is, though. I assume the 21st happens, and that the 25th, the 26th would be, like, the week they'd be off. Unless the 28th, but I don't know for certain. Also, real quick, if you stay into the very end of this podcast, we're gonna get ready to do the Weekly Manga Recap Superlative Awards. So, I think, every couple days, or maybe even every day for the next couple, weeks or however long until then, I'm going to post up a category via the Weekly Manga Recap Twitter. So at WMR Podcast, I'm just going to post up the category, for example, Best Villain or something like that, and just send over any thoughts you have as to who you think should win it this year. It could be from the series we talk about, or any of, like, the series that have ended or anything like that. Send it over your suggestions. We're going to have a really awesome year-end episode. All right. Let's do MVPs.
Alright. My series this week was My Hero Academia. I think I really liked the tense confrontation going on between Bakugo and Deku. And as ridiculously stereotypically, alpha male as the whole, we will understand each other as our fists clash thing was, I think. I'm also curious to find out who the heck is pushing Aizawa.
I'm a little torn on this. Even now, I'm still kind of debating in my head between two, and that's, between My Hero and, Promised Neverland, but, I think I'm gonna go with My Hero just like you are. I think, it's a really good chapter. It's nice to see this kind of develop. It's a very significant chapter, I guess you could say, because if this really is going to be that big change in Bakugo, then that's a pretty big change from the status quo.
And for my MVP, Brook.
Because
he was badass this week.
He was very badass this week. I'm going to give mine to Don from Promised Neverland. This is a pretty big change for the character in making him sympathetic and interesting that I'm pretty excited to see going forward.
I like how my reason for choosing Don a couple ago, he did something stupid to get the plot moving, and yours is, well, he gave a very emotional...
He's becoming layered.
He became more important and connected to them. I was just like, he was stupid to move the plot forward, and I appreciate it.
What a big dum-dum. He made thing go good. Boosh. That does it.
That's it.
Let's head out of here, Nick. Let's get on our motorcycles and let's leave.
I know our motor caterpillars. One side. Coming good. Through.
Yeah, I'm gone now. I'm out of here. Just looks like my shoulder's still in frame while I slowly reach over to try to turn off this recording. You can't... That's just...
Stop recording!
This right here, this is a bush. My road bush in my room. Stop.